At some point about 2 or 3 years ago, we started a little bit of an email dialogue, and then it kind of died out for whatever reason. And I keep those kinds of things in a special file to look at for ideas for future conferences. And so I approached Max this year and asked him if he would be interested in talking at our conference. And as soon as he said, yeah, that kind of interested him, I got the first two books of this trilogy and just had a wonderful experience reading them. They're just very unique and beautifully written. And I want to tell you a few more comments that have been made by other people who have reviewed them. This first one is by Diane Cole, who was a reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune and an editor. First of all, she points out that the first book was the recipient of a coveted four-world Clarion five-star review. I'm not real familiar with what that is, but that's only one of many awards that Max has won. And she goes on to say that it's just a very unique telling of the story of a boy growing up in Bountiful, Utah. And this is the kind of book that, yes, it does have a lot of Mormon parts to it, but it's a unique, it's a universal story about a young man coming to a point where he figures out what it is he really wants to do in life and how he handles that with his family. And she says, besides being an engrossing and complex coming-of-age story, Journey is written in a lyrical yet gutsy style akin to the work of J.D. Salinger, Mark Twain, or John Steinbeck. And the writing is unusually good, I'll just have to tell you. After some bouncing around for a while, you went back to the University of Utah and got his degrees there, and then became a teacher and a writer at the University of Utah in the 1970s. And then he eventually accepted an invitation to YADO. It's a legendary artist retreat in upstate New York. By the end of the summer, he was teaching fiction writing at the State University of New York at Oswego. His first year there, Rolling Stone magazine praised him as a raw new voice in American fiction for Utah Died for Your Sins, his story that won the Pushcart Prize. This is a very short novel, and I just read it the other day, and I think I'm going to have to read it two more times to really figure it out. But it is very interesting. All right, someone else says, another reviewer said, called a raw new voice in American fiction by Rolling Stone magazine for his story, Utah Died for Your Sins, Pushcart Prize winner Max Zimmer was born in Switzerland and brought across the Atlantic at the age of four and was raised in, spent his whole growing up years in the Bountiful area. He has a lot of other published works. He has a collection, includes a collection of 47 stories titled Actual Mileage, poems, book reviews, magazine columns, short biographies, and liner notes for jazz albums. And if you read the book, she'll know why that is. And then one further one, Michael Strong from Zola Books said, Max Zimmer has written the great American Mormon novel. For decades, readers have depended upon a few extraordinary writers to understand fully what it means to be an American. Philip Roth, Julia Alvarez, Ralph Ellison, Erica Young, John Updike. Zimmer has added a critical new dimension to our shared national understanding of who we are and how we got here in the sweeping narrative that he writes. 12-year-old Sheikh Toffler's decade-long journey through the Mormon Church and beyond will resonate with all Americans who ponder their soul and places in our changing national portrait. And that just gives you some idea of the quality of the work. And I'm now going to turn the time over to Max. Whoops.
Hello? Yes. Can you hear me all the way back? Great. Thank you, Sue, for that wonderful introduction. It's so great to be here. I really consider you my folks, my people, and it's great to stand in front of an audience like you. I listened to your testimonies last night and was so touched with how honest you were. I've done a lot of readings from the books, and I always felt comfortable because I could hide behind the shield of the kid that I created, behind Shake's shield. This time, there's no shield. This time, this is my story. And I'm a little apprehensive, but I know you're my people, so that makes it that much better. Anyway, I'm going to take the bulk of my time telling my story, and it's a story on which the books are based, but the books are fiction. So, like Sue mentioned, I was born in Switzerland. I was brought to Utah at the age of four, during the post-war exodus of European members to Zion. My grandfather was a pretty famous man inside the church in Europe. He translated the Book of Mormon into German. He translated numerous hymns into German. Other documents the church needed German versions of. He also held the church together pretty much in Europe during the war. He would go to the German-speaking countries and to see how the saints were doing, help provide for them. In 1947, the church brought him to Utah to serve as their official translator. And a year later, my father and my two aunts followed with their families. And at first, all three families were holed up in my grandfather's unfinished basement in the avenues. And we hung blankets from the joists overhead so that we could have private rooms. And we stayed there for a few months, while everybody looked for work and their own places to live. For the next 4 years, my dad went from job to job. We lived from place to place while he looked for footing, while he looked to learn English. I heard my parents often ridiculed for their accents, and that came to me too. When I was in kindergarten, the teacher was a big polar bear of a woman named Mrs. Brick. And she would laugh at my mistakes. She would laugh at my broken English and get the class to laugh along with her. When she got tired of laughing, she would come down the aisle and whack me on the back of the head hard enough that I saw lightning. And that was when I really felt that she lived up to her name, because that's what it felt like she hit me with. So anyway, that motivated me. By the time I was in fifth grade, I was winning every spelling bee they could throw at me. 4 years later, 4 years after arriving in Utah, my family moved to a ranch in southern Utah called LaSalle. It was an absolute paradise for kids. I got to spend a summer in the mountains with the sheep herder tending his sheep. They gave me an old workhorse named Rex that I used to get to ride around the countryside. It was just a wonderful time. It was too short. 4 years later, we moved to a brand new home in the town of Bountiful, and that became our family home, and I still consider Bountiful my hometown today. My father put a lot of pressure on himself to fill his father's shoes. He immersed himself in the church. He saw that us kids immersed ourselves in the church too. He wanted us to be the model kid, the model Mormon kids that would live up to my grandfather's name. I tried for 7 years to fit that model. I did everything I was told. I was inducted into the priesthood when I was 12. I went on to win 7 individual achievement awards over the course of 7 years. And at the end, I earned a Duty to God award. For some reason, I never felt like I was good enough. I never felt like I lived up to my father's idea of my son. I could see him over those 7 years look with envy at the sons of other sons of other fathers, and see the son he wanted me to be. I never understood why. It was just this dark mystery in the back of my head that said, "You're not as good as you as they are. You're not as good as your friends are." I did everything they did. I didn't know what else to do. But at 12 years old, I was given the compass that would guide me through the priesthood, through a mission, and from there through the rest of my life. I went to high school at Bountiful High, and when I graduated, I joined the Army Reserve and went for 6 months active duty. The Army was wonderful. I know that's an oxymoron, but for the first time, I felt free. I felt equal. The guys I was with were from all parts of the country, from all different religions, but we all wore the same uniforms. Our backgrounds didn't matter. I felt like we were all starting from the same place. Most important was I was finally equal to the people that were around me. It was also my first introduction to what we then called Negroes. And they were wonderful. I had been taught to believe that they were cursed, that they were inferior, that they hadn't been valiant enough. But here they were. They were among the most valiant people in my units. From basic training, I went on to Fort Knox for tank training because I wanted to be a tanker. My dad had never let me buy a car, so I figured a tank, man, that's a car. Did 3 months training. At the end of that 3 months, they gave us an individual proficiency test in all aspects of tanking, firing, driving, gun sighting, disassembling and disassembling machine guns, main tank maintenance. I was the 7th guy in the history of 30,000 guys who had gone through the training program to score 100% on the individual proficiency test. That was cool. I was somebody, you know. There were no dark mysteries there. They held a special ceremony for me. They gave me an engraved Zippo lighter. I had a front page write-up in the Stars and Stripes, the Army newspaper. I told my father about it too. He went straight to the Church News with the story. The Church News ran the story under the headline, "Priest Wins Honor at Fort Knox." Priest? No, it was me. A soldier, a trainee. But that's how my dad was. Everything had to be subjugated to the church. I know you guys have had that experience. I came home from the Army. I proudly showed my father my Zippo lighter, my engraved Zippo lighter. The next day, it disappeared. I asked everybody in my family, "Who took my lighter? You know, where is it?" My father finally admitted that he'd thrown it out. I said, "Why? Why? It was an award. I don't even smoke." He said, "Well, I don't care. In this house, we have to avoid even the appearance of evil. The next thing my compass pointed at was a mission. In 1963, I was called on a 2.5-year mission to Austria. I was sent there to fill my grandfather's shoes. People didn't let me forget that. I was sent there with the expectation that I would harvest Austria for the Lord. Austria was ripe for the harvest, and I was the one that was going to start it off. I'm like, okay, well, the average baptism rate in Austria was one baptism per missionary per mission. So it was a long way from there to harvesting an entire country. It was during my mission, about 8 months in, that I found a little red book underneath a bed in one of the rooms, in a room I was staying in at that time. It was an anthology of contemporary American poetry. I was reading the Book of Mormon. I was slogging through this horrible imitation of the Bible. Dead language. All of a sudden, language was alive for me. I'd never known it was possible to do what these poems did just with words. And suddenly I was writing too, and suddenly I knew what I wanted to do with my life, which was to write. Word got out that I was a writer, and they made me the writer and editor of the mission newsletter. Nobody had been reading it. It was pious, it was church speak. Baptisms were written up and made religious heroes out of the missionaries who were lucky enough, the rare missionaries who were lucky enough to score baptisms. It depressed every other missionary in the field. It deepened the futility and the spiritual fatigue that they faced day after day after day of rejection. My feeling was, they don't need that. They need some comic relief. They need to know that they can crack jokes. So I reported baptisms. I wrote limericks to report baptisms. I wrote new lyrics to hymns. I had a blast, and it became a hit. People couldn't wait to get their monthly newsletter. At the same time, I knocked on doors, tried new approaches to getting at people that I'm ashamed of today, like using little kids to get to their parents. But I was there to fill my grandfather's shoes. I didn't care. Whatever tools I had at my disposal, that was my personal mission. Then came the day that my compass was shattered. 14 months into my mission, I was made a senior. I went down to the train station in Vienna to meet my junior. Right off the train, this guy was peppering everything he said with the F word. "Oh, you're the guy who writes that great effing newsletter." Wow, look at that effing broad. Every other missionary used the word fuzz. You've probably heard that. He used the real word. He was 28, I was 20, he was 8 years older than me. He was a man of the world, to me anyway. He'd been a flight engineer for United Airlines, and he told me that his goal had been to have sex with a different stewardess every night. I was a virgin. I was up against this guy. That night, he wanted to go to a wine cellar. I said, "No! No!" He took me by the lapels and slammed me up against the wall of a building. I could see this crazy glitter, and I mean, slammed me up against the wall of the building so hard I saw lightning again like I had in kindergarten. This crazy glitter in his eyes, I could feel his strength. There was no way I could stand up to it. So we went to a wine cellar. I figured, well, I'll go along, see if I can find a way to control him. We got drunk. So much for me. So much for Harvest in Austria, right? And then when the wine cellar closed, we found a couple of prostitutes. They took us to a back street hotel, got keys from the desk clerk and took us to our separate rooms. And I was a 20-year-old virgin. I was a drunk virgin. I didn't know what to do with a woman's body. No idea. But I did it. Eventually, I did it. We came out of the hotel. He was furious that he'd had to pay for it. He turned around, went back in, beat this old man that was the desk clerk almost to death. Just beat the living daylights out of him. The next morning, the story was in the papers. The guy had to be taken to the hospital. They didn't know whether he would live or die, and they were looking for the guy who had done it to him. That they were looking for my companion gave me some leverage over him. I could always rat him out. I would go in as an accomplice, but I didn't care. He was the perpetrator. And that kind of reined him in a little bit. But at night, he still wanted to go out and do his werewolf thing, and I would just have to let him go. I was with him for 3 months, and I knew that I had committed an excommunicable sin. I felt terrible. I hated myself. I hated what I'd done. There was no way to reverse it. I couldn't go back to being a virgin again. I didn't want to be excommunicated. I didn't want to disgrace my family. So I made a deal with a God that I no longer had a right to pray to, and asked him to his back, please let me finish my mission and I will work my heart out for you. Just let me go home. Just let me go home without this coming to light. I'll try to work it off, I promise. And I did. The subsequent juniors I worked with, I worked them hard. We tracted long hours from morning till it was socially acceptable to knock on doors at night. Racked up a lot of investigator hours, and finally baptized two young people. I let my juniors I gave my juniors the honor of baptizing them because I knew I wasn't worthy. They were thrilled. They thought I was just being generous. No. I was letting them do a job they were still worthy of doing. But essentially, I lived life like a fugitive. I didn't know when that call would come or that letter would come from the mission home telling me to report, to come in. They had something to talk to me about. It could come the next day. It could come 6 months from then. I was counting down the months till I could be clear and go home as an honorable missionary. It didn't happen. 9 months after that night, that call did come. They told me to report to the mission home, make the 4-hour drive from the town we were currently working. So we drove up. I met late that night with the mission president, who hated my newsletter. The contempt he had for me was thick. The anger he felt for me was thick. But in his office, he told me how they'd found me out. Stoddard, the flight engineer, had kept on going. chasing every skirt he could possibly chase. I had only done that one night, but he kept going. And a companion finally turned him in, and they grilled him for 2 days for the names of any other missionaries that might have participated with him. They said it'd be in their best interest to be turned in if he gave us their names. So he gave them my name. They excommunicated him, made sure he was out of the country, and then they called me. The mission president also told me that same night that nothing I had done in two years counted for anything. Thousands of investigator hours, thousands of attracting hours, hundreds of investigator hours, 2 baptisms, none of it counted. 2 years of my life were simply eradicated because of that single night. The hardest part was being told that the baptisms, the people I'd converted, their baptisms were tainted and weren't recognized by God because of what I'd done. They were innocent people. They thought they were Mormon. And here the mission president was telling me that they weren't. In the morning, they held an excommunication trial for me. The mission president acted as judge. He sat at the other end of a long conference table from me, and there was a big tape recorder right in the middle of the table. We both had microphones. They assigned a prosecutor. They assigned a defender. I said, no, I don't need a defender. I just want to confess. They called in 24 missionaries to serve as an audience. They were seated behind me. So I told my story. I told my story of that humiliating night. The mission president kept asking me to repeat the key moment. You know? He said, we need to make certain that you actually penetrated her. You were drunk. Tell us again. Are you sure? Over and over and over again, while these missionaries behind me had to, I don't know what they were thinking, but I could feel the heat on my back. And the tape, you know, they were listening. The tape recorder was making a permanent record of what I'd done. And at the end, when the mission president was finally satisfied, I was stripped of the priesthood. I was stripped of my membership. And the trial was over. They kept me around for a couple of days. They went out and bought boxer shorts for me and made me relinquish my garments, which was fine with me. That's our little secret, okay? And they asked me for all of the money I had. I had about $20 in Austrian money. I gave it to them. They said, we need to put it towards your plane ticket home. The church will loan you the rest. The church was not in the mood for paying plane fare for an excommunicated missionary to go home. So they left. I said, I have some change too. Do you want that? It was about 30 cents. They said, no, that's okay. You can keep that. And with that, 6 missionaries escorted me to the airport and onto the plane to make sure I got that flight. I remember nothing of the trip home. I was just consumed by how this would devastate and hurt my family, and also afraid of what was in store for me when I got there. With my shattered compass. My family, of course, was devastated. My brother Marv, my kid brother Marv, He was, 14, 15?
Yeah.
women were calling my mother to offer their sympathies and see what details they could dig out of her about what had really happened. I started the reinstatement process. Contrition for what I had done had to be absolute. Self-mortification is the subjugation of any appetites or desires, in other words, any identity, by self-denial or self-discipline is an aspect of religious penance. Put simply, self-mortification is the reduction of oneself to nothing. Self-mortification is what I practiced. I rejected writing. I rejected what I'd done with a newsletter. I rejected everything that was me. The first step in reinstatement was to stand in front of my congregation, tell them why I was home early, and ask their forgiveness. It wasn't the homecoming speech I'd expected to be giving, but it was the one I had. Standing at that pulpit in front of hundreds of my neighbors, among which my family sat, was the hardest thing I'd ever had to do to that day. The second step was to get a job to repay the church for my plane ticket. I got a job mowing lawns for Brown Floral. I don't know if anybody knows that company. Really? Me too. Yeah? Wow. Wow. You're way too young to have been there the same time I was. The third step was a monthly interview with the stake president. He was a good man. It would turn out that he would be the only good man in the reinstatement process that I had to report to. He was gentle and kind and empathetic and treated me with decency I didn't feel that I deserved. The fourth step was to go to church and obey the prohibitions. No sacrament, no priesthood meeting, no class participation in Sunday school, no tithing, no contribution of any kind, including a contribution to my other brother, who was leaving on his mission in 3 or 4 months. I cheated, though. I gave him some money. I kept my head down at church because I was terrified of making accidental eye contact with anyone's daughter. Going to church was the hardest part. To sit there like a canker among good people, like a pariah among my family. The shame and self-loathing I felt among them and the pain I was causing my family became unbearable. I thought, well, if I stopped going and went away, the hole that I had torn in the fabric of my congregation and my family could close over, and my family could go back to being a somewhat normal family again. I moved into a Salt Lake apartment with a couple of guys from work. I worked a string of jobs. Before long, I started drifting. I dropped out of college. I was in engineering school. I got a job as a Holiday Inn airport driver, and I bootlegged booze for out-of-town businessmen who were terrified that they couldn't get a drink in the state. I just ran up to the liquor store and got them whatever they wanted. They'd slip me a 20, they were so grateful. I kept one dream, one desire, one appetite that I'd had since I saw my first one when I was 12 years old. I bought an old used Porsche. I hooked up with a gang of guys who all had old sports cars. We would rally up. We would meet at Sears every Saturday or Sunday morning, rally up and down the canyons, raise hell, mess with girls, drink. One night we were coming down Provo Canyon into Provo, and I had a bright idea of, hey, let's do a panty raid on BYU. So we drove and we snaked around. I mean, this long string of sport, old ratty old sports cars, snaked around the campus until we found a girl's dorm. Got in, were just a bunch of hooligans running up and down the halls while girls screamed. Somebody called the cops. I got to my car. Me and a couple of other guys got to our cars quick enough to jump the curb and go off across the grass and get away. Everybody else got caught. The next day in the BYU paper, front page, a photograph of these sad-looking characters in the headlights of cop cars. And the headline, Hell's Angels Invade BYU. That was another badge of honor I was proud to show my father. But I didn't. Then one night, during that drifting period, I don't know the date, but it was winter, my life changed again. One of my roommates introduced me to a waitress at Dee's Family Restaurant. She was beautiful. More than that, she was kind. I could see her kindness in the way she served other people at their tables. And I pretty much fell in love right there. I drove her home, and I found out how poor her family was. She lived on State Street. Who lives on State Street? I thought. Who? I used to drag State Street. I never saw a house. I used to get in fights on State Street. I never saw a yard. But she lived with her family in an old condemned house between a transmission shop and a radiator shop. But her parents were inactive. Her father was out of work. She and her siblings held to the church for the order and hope it offered them. It was pretty much all they had. I knew that she dreamed of a temple marriage to a returned missionary. I knew that I was in love with her. I didn't want her to get to like me too much before she knew what I really was. So on the second date, parked in front of her house so that to give her the choice of getting out of the car and going back inside and never seeing me again. I told her I wasn't the kind of returned missionary she thought I was. And I told her why. And then I sat there and just looked at my horn button while she thought things over. And then I felt her take my hand. And this is tough. Thank you, Sue. I knew right then, for the first time in months, I felt like I could be human again. I knew then how deeply kind she really was, and I knew that she would stand by me no matter what came. That's when I stopped the drift. The directionless drift that started when my compass was shattered back in Austria. I started picking up its pieces, trying to put them back together again. It was tough because they were damaged. The needle was crooked. It wasn't sure where true north was. The lens was gone. The dial was dented and scratched. But I promised myself to give her the temple marriage that she'd always dreamed of. I moved back home to start my reinstatement again. I picked up school again as an engineering student. I dropped the sports car gang that I'd been messing around with. I started my interviews again. I went back to church. She came to church with me, where she was able to partake of the sacrament that I had to pass on. About that time, I was passed up to my next round of interviews, and they were with Apostle Delbert Stapley. He was brutal. He was invasive. He was just a very angry man, especially when it came to me, of course. There were moments that I'll never forget. I told him about my girl, how I wanted to give her the dream of a temple marriage. He asked me, "Have you touched her?" I cried out. I said, "No, no, no, of course not. No." He said, "Well, we know where your hands have been." He asked me about her standards, how she could possibly have high standards when her parents weren't active. A month later, I asked how much longer my reinstatement might take so that we could plan our wedding. He told me that if I ever expressed impatience again, I could come back in 2 years and we could start the process over. The most devastating thing he said to me was, "We can take her away from you anytime we want." I still remember how that terrified me. She was all I had, and I think he knew that. The message of the church so far had been to teach me to hate and deny myself and feel worthless. And they were really successful at that. On the other hand, my girl and her impoverished family, who lived on State Street, were just the opposite. They loved me. Their love was unconditional. They saw me as a human, a good kid, an individual. The way they looked at me had nothing to do with the way the church looked at me. In their condemned house on State, I started to feel like I did have value. Her father became my father. He tried to convince me to walk away. I didn't know how to. I just didn't know how to. Unless I gave her daughter her dream. I was eventually reinstated. My father baptized me and gave me the priesthood for the second time in my life. And with that, the church had done its job. They had made me as good as new. They had washed away the sin of that night in Vienna. They had made me worthy again in the eyes of God. I was an elder again. What they couldn't wash away was the emotional and psychological damage that 2 years of self-hatred had done. That hard part was left to me. We went ahead and planned our marriage, and just as we were scheduled to go to the temple, Apostle Stapley gave me the worst possible news. Because they weren't members in good standing, her parents could not come to see their daughter married. We were married in the temple while our parents waited at home for the reception. I would give anything to go back and relive that moment now, or take that young man by the hand. Tell Apostle Stapley to shove his temple up his butt sideways. Lead that kid out of there with his girl and say, "Let's go. Come on, this is over. Let's go get married." I started following the compass again. It was damaged, as I was. My bride and I settled into a ward below the U, and became the model Mormon couple. Around us, the 60s were exploding. So the civil rights movement, the Vietnam War, the streets were full of protests. Led Zeppelin, the Beatles. We scrupulously avoided all of it. It was of the world stuff. We were only in there. We both taught Sunday school, and I served as a counselor on the Elders Quorum. But something wasn't right. I was still locked into the self-denial I'd practiced so zealously during my reinstatement. I was still in engineering. I still wouldn't go near writing. I still hated myself. I was still too damaged to feel like I could be truly loved. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I needed therapy badly, but I didn't know it. My young wife's love was bottomless. I had increasing trouble accepting it. As time passed, I wanted her to hate me too. I used cruelty to try to provoke her to do that. Late at night, I had an old Porsche Speedster by then, a rust bucket that I turned into a race car. Late at night, when things just got too crazy, when Salt Lake just closed in on me, and everything that happened to me just closed in on me, I would back that car out of the driveway and snake it up through the city into Immigration Canyon and race up and down the canyons just wild until my head was clear enough that I could come down Parley's pretending like I'd never been to Salt Lake and I was just passing through. And that briefly would make Salt Lake livable again for me and I could go home and sleep. 6 years into our marriage, I reached critical mass. My head was exploding. I'd tasted writing again in a couple of English courses I took, and I began to take my carefully constructed Mormon life apart again. I stopped going to church. One Sunday, I just stopped going. I was done. I no longer considered myself a Mormon. This time, I left on my own terms. I left engineering. I left in my senior year and crossed campus to the humanities side. Orson Spencer Hall, for those of you who are familiar with the campus. I finally started writing 8 years after my excommunication, 9 years since I'd discovered that little red book under that bed in an Austrian town. There was my marriage. That had to go too. I broke it up and left my wife without ever finding the bottom of her love for me. I simply had to walk away from it. There was Martin Luther King. I saw I had watched him courageously lead the civil rights movement, courageously face down dogs, cops, racists, everything else, politicians. I'd seen him assassinated. And I looked at that man. He was gone by then, but I looked at him and I said, I have something that I was worthy of having as a 12-year-old brat. Here's this courageous man out leading his people out of oppression. Valiant, the most valiant man I could imagine. And he wasn't worthy of something I'd had since the age of 12. That pretty much sealed the deal for me. That let me know something was wrong. There was my father. Once I walked away from these pieces of my life, he wanted nothing to do with me. I'd betrayed him again. I'd given him back the compass that he gave me when I was 12. Damaged, inoperable, ultimately useless. I was free now to go full throttle into my dream. I was accepted into the graduate writing program at the U. I started writing and also started teaching. Before long, I was the star writer of the program. Established writers like Grace Paley, E.L. Doctorow, and John Cheever, who visited the U, loved and championed my work. I published my first short story called Utah Died for Your Sins, and Sue mentioned that. I won a Pushcart Prize for it and a write-up in Rolling Stone as a raw new voice in American fiction. I was proud. I was proud. This was something else to show my father. So I took the magazine up to their house, and played with my dog outside while he read the story. I went to go inside, and my mother stopped me, handed me the magazine back, and said, here it is. And I said, well, what did he think? What did he think? She says, Maxie, he says it is the blackest day of his life. I didn't care. I just kept going. I just kept writing. I was living in the center of my dream. But there was a downside. Tremendous guilt for a wonderful wife who devoted years to me and whose innocent heart I'd broken. For betraying my father again. For turning away from an angry and vengeful God I still believed in and everyone else I'd hurt in order to have my way. I felt like an outlaw living my dream at the cost of all that hurt. That sooner or later, God's hammer would come down on me again. I earned a master's and was working on a doctorate when I was invited to Yaddo, the retreat that Sue mentioned. I was working on a wild panoramic novel of the West that E.L. Doctorow had asked me to send him as soon as it was finished, and he'd make sure that it was published. So I moved east, spent 3 months at this bug house. I mean, this was a crazy crowd at that retreat. Composers, artists, sculptors, everybody was on the make. It didn't matter what or who you were. It was just crazy. So it goes without saying that I didn't finish my novel there. But I picked up a job as a fiction instructor at the State University of New York at Oswego. I love teaching there. I used some creative approaches to break my students of the college structure and get them to the truth of their stories. My courses were popular. I became known for some reason as Max the Legend around campus. Four guys from Long Island formed a punk rock cover band and called themselves Max Zimmer. Put an extra X in the space between the two names. And actually, when they graduated, took that name back to Long Island and played for a few years under that name. I was a little peeved that they'd made my name famous before I did. I left after 2 years to pursue my own writing. I moved into Manhattan. I ended up living there for 8 years, tending bar, doing technical writing for the Department of Energy, all the while working on my voice as a fiction writer, looking for a way to tell the story I had to tell. Even though many other writers I knew tried to persuade me to write about my own material growing up Mormon, I knew that if I wrote anything about Mormonism, it would hurt my father more. I'd hurt him enough. So I just wrote around the edges and left Mormonism out. In Manhattan, I fell in love with my wife, Toni. She was a New York girl. Both of us were tired of the city by then, and we moved to Jersey, where we started a business as writers for the electric power industry. Ever since leaving for writing, I'd been building my own compass. Fits and starts, mistakes, guilt, lots of mistakes. I finally realized that I needed therapy. I spent years in a therapist's office learning how to feel entitled to write again, clearing myself of the remnants of guilt and shame. I finally finished that compass when I settled in and started writing If Where You're Going Home, my series of novels, for the first time. This coming-of-age story of a kid named Shake Toffler growing up Mormon in Utah with a dream to play jazz trumpet. How the project was born in my summer between my 2 years at Oswego. What time is it? Okay, five, just a few more minutes, and I want to read a couple of things to you, that's all. I wrote, during that summer in Oswego, I wrote a long story about the breakup of my marriage to let my wife know that it was all me, that none of it was her. I wanted to pay tribute to her. In Jersey, I started to turn that story into a novel. I quickly realized I was writing just another love story, just another heartbreak love story, that readers really wouldn't get what the marriage was about without the underlying dynamic of self-hatred and worthlessness involved in growing up Mormon. So I had to back up and tell that story from an earlier starting point. I went back to my mission and excommunication. That wasn't enough. I finally realized you have to go back to the beginning. You have to go back to that 12th year birthday when you really embark on the journey through what the church can do. And so that's what I did. And suddenly one novel grew to four novels. The first two are published. I just finished the third one. It's called Instrument of the Lord, and it deals entirely with Jake's time in Austria and his excommunication. So now I had the whole story. I finally outgrew the fear and guilt of hurting my father. After the many years I'd spent in the East, living among of-the-world people, and finding out that they're just as virtuous and decent as any Mormon people I'd ever known, I wanted to make the Mormon experience universal. I really wanted to put it on a map alongside Catholicism and Judaism and other religions as part of the American culture, this uniquely American religion, so full of ironic material, I thought would be a great story. That's what I did. I took a 12-year-old kid, I put him straight through the heart of growing what it is to grow up Mormon, Sunday school lessons, priesthood lessons, everything. The key to making it universal was not to write first about the Mormon church, but to write first about a boy with a dream. Everybody could understand that. I made it about jazz and about its Negro heroes because I wanted to put him through the conflict of the musicians he learned everything from against what he'd been taught to believe about them. And I also made it about Mormonism. So that's it. The compass I was given and instructed to follow when I turned 12 was never my real compass. It always led me in a rigid and punishing direction, away from my true self and away from what I know is my purpose. The compass I have now, the compass I created in finding my own direction, is my own. It has always been true. Thanks for listening. Thank you so much. So I have another 15 minutes just to do a couple of quick readings. Okay. The four books, the first one is called Journey. It starts when he moves to Bountiful and first hears the sound of the trumpet on the radio of the cattle truck that is moving the family from the ranch to their new home. It takes him from falling in love with the sound of a trumpet to doing the yard work in order to buy a used one that he could teach himself to play. And from there, through eventually finding a teacher and eventually forming a band, a high school band, and succeeding at his dream against strong odds. Book one tells that story. Book two takes him from there, from the age of 15, through high school, through Dragon State Street, through priesthood, and ends at the airport as he's about to leave on his mission. It also takes him through a love story. Book three, as I said, is all about his mission in Austria. Book four is about his homecoming and his eventual redemption through the love of the waitress that made such a difference in his life. So I've got a bunch here for sale. I'm only charging what it costs to print and ship them out here, just $10 a copy. They're normally retail for around $18. So, and you can get them autographed too if you like. I'm going to read a couple of scenes, one from each book. The first scene is one that Sue asked for. When he first brings his trumpet home from the music store that he buys it from, his mother goes into a rage. Just says, "I can't have this in this house. You take it back or I'll destroy it." He ends up hiding it in the garage. He goes through the summer into the seventh grade, never taking it out. In school, he sees kids going up and down the halls with their instrument cases. He shadows them. He finds the band room and stands outside listening, feeling like an outsider because for some reason he couldn't have his instrument. He's also recently been ordained a deacon, and he's been waiting for the Holy Ghost to ignite the burning in his bosom. So this scene comes when he goes to the Thanksgiving assembly at school in November, and here's a girl that he's befriended play Danny Boy on her violin. Her name is Carla. I tell the entire story in second person. You do this, you do that, as a way to let people be the character that. That is really the star of the book. Let people become that person. And it works, I'm told. Here's the scene. You watch Carla step forward with her violin. A cleared patch of dirt, a circle of rocks, clean dry firewood stacked on the kindling of grass and twigs, gradually larger sticks, until you are up to logs arranged on top like the poles of a teepee, plenty of room for air, the way Manny taught you the summer you spent with him and his sheep in the mountains. You could still remember him saying a fire had to breathe. You built it right. It was ready to burn in your bosom. All it needed was a match, a spark from the Holy Ghost. But the Holy Ghost had come along, looked at you, looked at the fire you'd built, and kept on going. You've kept it dry for him. He hasn't come back. But now, from back in the dimmed auditorium, you watch Carla step into the spotlight and hear her play a song so lonely and sad and beautiful, you never thought it could come from her. And while you sit there listening to the strike and pull of her bow across the strings, you finally feel the flame catch hold in the grass, send its shoots up slowly through the kindling of the twigs, and then into the bigger sticks, and then the logs. The 14-year-old boy who found a place in the woods, the boy your father would love to have had for a son. After the assembly, the fire inside your chest still warm, you find a place too. Home from school that day, you sneak the case out from behind the Christmas boxes, brush the cobwebs off, climb the hill, find a place where you can get on your knees too. Not in a grove of the woods, but a place in the dirt toward the back of the sand pit, a level place where a couple of banks of bulldozed rubble shield you from the hopper, the steam shovel, the loop of road the trucks have left across the floor. You lay the case on its back in the dirt. You get on your knees not to pray, but to unsnap the latches, lift back the lid, take out the lesson book, and there it is, the way you left it. The bruised and burnished sheen of its brass, the deep shining gold of its pipes, the valve casings, the ivory-tipped plungers for your fingers, the dent in the bell, the tuning slide still set where Mr. Hinkle left it when he tuned it to his big piano. Your knees are cold in the dirt. Underneath your right knee, the spike of a tiny rock bites into the bone. You lift the trumpet off its cradle. Small, quick halos of steam form on the cold brass around your fingertips. You slip the mouthpiece in, not tight, give it a little twist to lock it, lace your fingers around the cold casings, tuck in your thumb. You remember everything. Middle C, how the flow comes from your lungs, how the hard cup of the mouthpiece feels. Second scene is from Of the World. I guess you folks all remember Ward teaching. Okay. In this scene, Sheikh has recently turned 16, is a brand new priest in the Aaronic priesthood. He's looking to go Ward teaching with some other men, but his father grabs him as a partner. This scene is a visit to one of their families. Your father has you drive. Brother Soderstrom's big white Freightliner truck is parked next to the house with its tall grill and high fenders and ghost headlights facing the street. It dwarfs the little house. You hand your father the key to the wagon. He knocks on their door. Brother Soderstrom lets you in. Their little living room is thick with the smell of fish. Sister Soderstrom rounds up their little girl and their two little boys, while Brother Soderstrom brings in the usual chair for you from the kitchen. They arrange their kids around themselves on the sofa the way they always do, obedient and prepared, like your father's a photographer here to take their portrait. It makes you nervous. It makes you nervous now because you're here to look inside their family. The Soderstroms are nice, but there's always this fatigue in the way they talk and this hollow submission in their faces, like you could walk out the front door with their oblong coffee table and they'd let you go. Your father sits on the edge of the easy chair. You hear him ask the Soderstroms how they're doing. Listen to Brother Soderstrom say they're doing fine. Hear your father ask if there's anything they need help with. Watch Sister Soderstrom start fidgeting with her little girl's hair. Watch Brother Soderstrom glance at his wife before you realize he's fishing for a way to answer your father's question. No, he finally says, nothing I can think of. We're doing okay, aren't we, Shirley? If that's what you call it, Fred. Let's not get into that, Shirley. Sister Soderstrom keeps running her fingers through the same place in her daughter's hair like she's a cat. Their boys sit on the rug in their diapers and rubber pants and look at your father and you. Let's not get into that, Shirley. He asked, Fred. I don't see why we can't be honest about it. That's okay, honey. We'll work it out. Sister Soderstrom takes her fingers out of her little girl's hair and puts her hand on the armrest at the end of the sofa. Tell him, Fred, maybe it's time we asked for some help. We'll work it out, Shirley. Sister Soderstrom turns to your father. Fred lost his job. He can't find work. Surely? No, Fred, I'm sorry. She looks at your father again. Fred hasn't had work in 4 months. The truck's broke, and it was spotty before that, with other repairs it needed. We can't afford to fix it this time. He's trying to sell it. We'll just keep praying about it, Shirley, asking the Lord. We can't ask the Lord, Fred, not the way we've gotten behind. Shirley, Fred, listen to me. We need help. I've got a couple of people interested, Shirley. You know that. I talked to Consolidated, too. We're just about to turn the corner. 4 months, you're thinking. You've sat here not knowing a thing. He wants to take out a loan, she tells your father, to catch up on our tithing. A loan's the only way, Shirley. We still owe on last year's, for Pete's sake. We can't even get our temple recommends renewed. I'm not saying I'm against the loan, Fred. I'm just being honest. Listen, Shirley, another week or two will be okay. Let's drop this. Let's get to the lesson. Sister Soderstrom looks at your father head on in a way you've never seen anyone look at him. Not with any kind of look, just plain, the way she might look at a rock or something she's got in a frying pan. On the edge of the sofa, she's got her knees together under her dress, one hand on her little girl's back to keep her quiet. Tell me something, Brother Toffler. She says, why is it 10%? Why not 8 or 7? Or 4 or 12 or 13? Your father looks at her. He hasn't known either. I don't know, he says. All I know is that tithing is defined at 10%. As 10%. That's what the church expects. I don't care about definitions. I know what the church expects. But why does my faith in Joseph Smith depend on dollars? On one out of every $10. If I give a dollar less than 10%, my faith in Joseph Smith isn't good enough? Surely, no, Fred, not taking her eyes off your father. These kids here, they're ours, but they're God's too. And it's our duty to God to feed them, keep them healthy, make sure they've got clothes, a roof over their heads. Honey, let me be. And then back to your father. So tell me, I know we're supposed to pay our tithing first, before our house payment, Fred's truck payment, groceries, doctor bills, everything. And if we do that, then God will help us cover the rest. Well, we've tried that for a while. God just took too long. We've got 3 kids to feed, his kids. Brother Soderstrom is looking down at his hands. Your father sits there looking back at Sister Soderstrom with his anguish trapped in his face. Even you know what's happening. The public suicide of Sister Soderstrom's testimony. You don't say the kind of stuff she said. You know that. And then, like she knows it too, she starts to cry, so quietly that the only way you can tell is the way her eyes go red. Sorry. And her cheeks turn wet in the light from the floor lamp next to your father's chair. I'm sorry, she says. I'm so sorry. Mommy? It's okay, she says, and reaches down and sweeps her daughter up while Brother Soderstrom heaves himself over and puts his arm around her. One of her diapered boys starts spanking the rug. I'm sorry, your father says. I didn't know. You know what a loan is. Money you borrow from a bank to buy something, like a house or a car. Like your father did the Chevy wagon, and your buddy West keeps talking about doing once he passes driver's ed. You've never heard of a loan where you borrow money just to turn around and give it to someone else, where you get it from the bank so you can hand it to the church. Outside again, heading for the wagon, your father offers you the key. That's okay, you say, thanks. In the wagon, following the headlights home in the dusk from the Soderstroms, where your father left a long prayer on the coffee table, you want to know if the church can't just give them a temple recommend now and wait till Brother Soderstrom's got a job again. If the church can't wipe out the tithing they owe and then let them start out fresh. But you know from the busy way your father's back teeth are clacking not to bother him. And you know the rule yourself. Pay your tithing first. Trust the rest to God. Settle your tithing at the end of every year with Bishop Byrne so you can keep your temple recommend. If the Soderstroms had kept up with their tithing, they wouldn't be in trouble. If they had enough faith to go ahead and pay it, God would have looked out for them. He would have blessed them tenfold. He would have opened a way for Brother Soderstrom to fix his truck or find another job by now. You sit back, watch houses go past outside, the houses of your neighbors, where the last of the sunset chases you up the hill in this dull red moving gash across the repeating sheets of iron that are their picture windows. Okay, that's it, folks. Thank you so much.